I wouldn't put Hempstead, a city in New York, on the same plane as one in Honduras. What a scandal. Official accounts in the United States, what circulates in the newspaper or on the radio, the message from Washington, and public opinion in general, almost always locate the dividing line between civilization and barbarity, just below the Rio Grande. A brief, particularly disconcerting article in the New York Times in October 2014 postulated a series of questions and rapid responses about the child migrants from Central America. The questions themselves had a tendentious tone. "Why aren't child migrants immediately deported?" one of them said, as if baffled or enraged by the fact that the children are not met at the border with catapults that will return them to their home countries. If the questions themselves showed a light bias, the answers were worse. They seemed like something from an openly racist 19th century magazine or a reactionary anti-immigration serial, not the Times. Under a statute adopted with bipartisan support, minors from Central America cannot be deported immediately. But a United States law allows Mexican minors caught crossing the border to be sent back quickly. Note, the majority of children are not caught. They turn themselves over to Border Patrol. Another question read, "Where are the child migrants coming from?" The answer, "More than three quarters of the children are from mostly poor and violent towns in three countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras." The emphasis is mine, of course, but it underscores the less than subtle bias in the portrait of the children. Children caught while crossing illegally, laws that permit their deportation, children who come from the poor and violent towns. In short, barbarians who deserve subhuman treatment. The attitude in the United States toward child migrants is not always blatantly negative. But generally speaking, it is based on a kind of misunderstanding or voluntary ignorance. Debate around the matter has persistently and cynically overlooked the causes of the exodus. When causes are discussed, the general consensus and underlying assumption seem to be that the origins are circumscribed to sending countries and their many local problems. No one suggests that the causes are deeply embedded in our shared hemispheric history, and are therefore not some distant problem in a foreign country that no one can locate on a map, but in fact, a transnational problem that includes the United States. Not as a distant observer or passive victim that must now deal with thousands of unwanted children arriving at the southern border, but rather as an active historical participant in the circumstances that generated that problem. The belief that the migration of all those children is their, the southern barbarians' problem, is often so deeply ingrained that we, the northern civilization, feel exempt from offering any solution. The devastation of the social fabric in Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, and other countries is often thought of as a Central American gang violence problem that must be kept on the far side of the border. There is little said, for example, of arms being trafficked from the United States into Mexico or Central America, legally or not. Little mention of the fact that the consumption of drugs in the United States is what fundamentally fuels drug trafficking in the continent. But the drug circuit and its many wars, those openly declared and those that are silenced, are being fought in the streets of San Salvador, San Pedro Sula, Iguala, Tampico, Los Angeles, and Hempstead. They're not a problem circumscribed to a small geographic area. The roots and reach of the current situation branch out across hemispheres and form a complex global network whose size and real reach we can't even imagine. It's urgent that we begin talking about the drug war as a hemispheric war, at least, one that begins in the Great Lakes of the northern United States and ends in the mountains of Selake, in southern Honduras. It would surely be a step forward for our governments to officially acknowledge the hemispheric dimensions of the problem, acknowledge the connection between such phenomena as the drug wars gangs in Central America and the United States, the trafficking of arms from the United States, the consumption of drugs, and the massive migration of children from the Northern Triangle to the United States through Mexico. No one, or almost no one, from producers to consumers, is willing to accept their role in the great theater of devastation of these children's lives. To refer to the situation as a hemispheric war would be a step forward, because it would oblige us to rethink the very language surrounding the problem and, in doing so, imagine potential directions for combined policies. But of course, a war refugee is bad news and an uncomfortable truth for governments, because it obliges them to deal with the problem instead of simply removing the illegal aliens. When I ask Manu one day what he thinks of Hempstead, he says it is almost as ugly as Tegucigalpa, but at least it was home to Method Man from the Wu-Tang Clan, and you could get good CDs there. In a later web search, to corroborate the random fact about Method Man, I find that Hempstead is also where Walt Whitman lived for a while, and where the most obese man in the world was born. In the weeks that follow, I buy some books and start reading about the town. It is a broken community that has served as a stage for the Bloods and the Crips for more than 40 years. The rapper A+ released a 1999 album called Hempstead High. The hit single from the album is called Enjoy Yourself. And in it, A+ speaks of knocking the teeth out of the smile of anyone who has beef. I listen to the song on repeat as I ride the train one day on my way to Hempstead, the irony of those words pounding in my head. Certainly, the Barrio 18 of Tegucigalpa would have done much worse than knock out Manu's front teeth, as the Hempstead 18 had done. But I imagine that, in his nights of adolescent rage and desperation, he wonders why this story all over again, why he ever came to the United States. One day in court, I try to explain the phrase, de Guatemala a Guatepeor, from Guatabad to Guataworse, to a lawyer. In translation, the phrase loses some of its meaning, but it can be glossed this way. Almost 5,000 kilometers separate Tapachula, the Guatemala-Mexico border town from which La Bestia departs, from New York. Hundreds of thousands of kids have made the journey. Tens of thousands have made it to the border. Thousands to cities like Hempstead. Why did you come to the United States? We ask. They might ask a similar question. Why did we risk our lives to come to this country? Why did they come when, as if in some circular nightmare, they arrive at new schools, in their new neighborhoods, and find there the very things they were running from? 38. What do you think will happen if you go back home? Some months later, in a phone interview with Alina, in which I'm still trying to put some pieces of the story together, she tells me that she saved up for years to bring her two daughters and Manu to New York, but she decided to stop saving and go into debt to bring Manu as soon as she realized it was no longer a joke. No longer children's games, she says. They killed his friend in front of him, you know, and I knew he'd be next. 39. Are you scared to return? In the same conversation, Alina also tells me that she brought the girls over after some pandilleros from the gang that killed Manu's friend started waiting outside her eldest daughter's school every day, following her slowly back home on motorbikes as she walked along the side of the road, trying not to look back. Up until then, the idea of letting the children travel alone with a coyote had been unimaginable. Crossing borders, mounting La Bestia, suddenly, the idea of allowing them to stay in Tegucigalpa became even more unimaginable. 40. Who would take care of you if you were to return to your home country? If the answer is no one, the only option you have is to leave and never go back. Alina contacted the same coyote that brought Manu to the United States and asked him to bring her daughters over. The older of the two girls is 19, not a child anymore. Alina explained, So she was separated from her younger sister and put directly in jail with other adults. Alina had to pay $7,500 to get her out of the detention facility as quickly as possible. I don't ask where she's getting all the money. I suppose that her and her husband's entire life savings have all gone into bringing their three teenagers over. The children who cross Mexico and arrive at the U.S. border are not immigrants, not illegals, not merely undocumented minors. Those children are refugees of a war, and as such, they should all have the right to asylum. But not all of them have it.
Tell me how it ends, Mama,
my daughter asks me. I don't know.
Tell me what happens next.
Sometimes I make up an ending, a happy one. But most of the time I just say, I don't know how it ends yet. Chapter 4. Community. In my first semester teaching at Hofstra University, I was assigned a class called, somewhat blandly, Advanced Conversation. The only thing I'd been told about the course was that I needed to speak Spanish with the students. The rest was up to me. Since I wasn't sure what would get students to talk, I started talking to them on day one about the undocumented minors' immigration crisis, the only current topic that I knew enough about, and that seemed inexhaustible and urgent enough to devote at least a few class meetings to. During our first encounters, the 10 students in the class looked at me silently and with a sort of congealed bewilderment, which I usually prefer to attribute to their excess of hormones and lack of sleep, rather than to their apathy or my want of better teaching skills. And I think I may have been right this time not to judge them or myself too harshly, too quickly. Midway into the semester, they started to speak up. They began asking difficult questions and started articulating sophisticated opinions. We decided to refer to the class as the Migration Think Tank rather than Spanish Conversation. As the weeks passed, one student, who at the beginning of the semester had argued that the United States had too many internal problems to deal with the burden of receiving more immigrants, became the most extreme supporter of the idea that the immigration of children into the United States should be conceived of not as a foreign affairs problem, but as a local concern. Conscious of my own limitations in the subject matter, I brought in experts to talk to us, immigration lawyers, social workers, activists, and political scientists. The semester rolled on, and it seemed to me that for once, a class I was giving was not just following a syllabus, but also growing quite naturally out of our group's shared concerns and questions. United States law guarantees free public education for all children, no matter their nationality or immigration status. Every child living in U.S. territory has this right. But not all children know this, nor do their parents necessarily know it. With the large influx of new migrant children, many schools in the country are overwhelmed, and negligent administrators simply push parents back when they call to ask about enrollment. Many school districts have reacted by creating more obstacles for newcomers. One of those districts is New York's Nassau County, which has the fifth largest population of migrant children in the country. It is also the district where I work. Public schools in Nassau County have denied entrance to many children based on their lack of appropriate immigration papers, something that is, by all means, an illegal practice. In the summer of 2015, the New York State Education Department held a compliance review and in the end determined that no public school was allowed to ask students for immigration documents of any type. But not all schools are complying. For months now, Alina has been trying to find a different school for Manu. The two girls are not as vulnerable to gang coercion, she thinks, provided that they keep to themselves. But she tells me that Manu can no longer go unnoticed. For a while he was admitted to a school in Long Beach, but then they told him his English wasn't good enough and that he needed to take language classes first. Other schools said he didn't meet the eligibility criteria, or that he's missing some document or another, or that there's simply no space. They all tell me no, no, and no. I ask her who they are. She's silent for a moment and then says, "Whoever answers the phone when I call a school." "So, what happens next?" I ask her. One October morning, my students come to class particularly anxious. While I explain a table of statistics on immigration patterns, they shuffle in their seats, whisper to each other, look around the classroom and out the window. I stop class and ask what is wrong with them, expecting to hear nothing back. But someone at last says, "Nothing, Prof."
"Nothing?"
"Nothing. We just want to tell you something," another says.
"What is it?"
I ask, sure that they will boycott or that they will ask to leave early that day. "Well, you know how you brought in that professor to talk to us? Professor Gauranathan?" "Yes, that one." I remember, of course. Nimi Gauranathan came to give us a lecture on the fundamentals of political activism. She insisted that the most important thing was to know how to transform emotional capital, the rage, sadness, and frustration produced by certain social circumstances, into political capital. "Yes, of course I remember that talk." "Well, we know how to do it now. We don't want to be voluntourists in our own town anymore. We want to do something that matters."
"What do you mean?" I ask.
Together, they explain the plan they have meticulously discussed ahead of time. They suggest using our remaining class time to create a political student organization. "To stop talking about the problem," one of them says, "and start doing something about it." I sit down and pay attention. Their idea is simple and brilliant. If the immigration crisis started at the U.S.-Mexico border, in southern Arizona or Texas, and then moved up all the way to the New York Immigration Court, and now there are children and teenage migrants living in the most remote towns of Long Island, it's not going to end there. The crisis will deepen and spread, and things will fall apart, unless all those kids find a way to become quickly and fully integrated. These kids have been through the worst. They arrive to find an unfamiliar country and a new language, but also a group of strangers that they must now call their family. They have to deal with family reunifications, interrupted education, acculturation, and trauma. Because Long Island and Nassau County in particular is so terribly deficient when it comes to public education and services, the private universities in the area have to offer some kind of sustained relief, my students say. "We have the space here, the resources, the classrooms, the football fields, and the radio station. The solutions have to be simple and concrete," they say. "No, let's empower the migrants" kind of empty jargon. "There have to be intensive English classes, college prep sessions, team sports, a radio program, and a civil rights and duties discussion group." They want to partner with organizations such as The Door in Manhattan and Strong, a nonprofit that focuses on teenagers in Long Island who are particularly vulnerable to falling into gangs. It only takes a group of 10 motivated students to begin making a small difference. Between the 10 of them, before my astonished, even disbelieving eyes, they draft a constitution, appoint duties, and get the university's approval. Their organization is called TIA, which plays on the Spanish tia, or aunt, and stands for Teenage Immigrant Integration Association. The United States is a country full of holes, and Hempstead, in particular, is a giant shithole, as Manu says. But it's also a place full of individuals who, out of a sense of duty toward other people, perhaps, are willing to fill those holes in, one by one. There are lawyers and activists who work tirelessly to help communities that aren't their own. There are students who, though not at all privileged, are willing to dedicate their time to those even less privileged than themselves. There are things that can only be understood retrospectively, when many years have passed and the story is ended. In the meantime, while the story continues, the only thing to do is tell it over and over again as it develops, bifurcates, not surround itself. And it must be told, because before anything can be understood, it has to be narrated many times in many different words and from many different angles, by many different minds. I started writing this essay in late November of 2015. At the time, my niece was preparing to major in law, interning with The Door, and working at City College for the Politics of Sexual Violence Research Initiative with one of the most lucid activists in the area. My green card had still not arrived, and my provisional work permit had expired the month before. I was not illegal, but it was illegal for me to work in the United States. I had to resign temporarily from my teaching job just before the final exam period. I would have taken a spontaneous vacation, but leaving 50 college students without a teacher after spending an entire semester with them weighed on me. I investigated further, asking several lawyers if I could continue working without pay. The answer, without a shade of ambiguity, was no. One is not allowed to volunteer at a job where one was previously paid while his or her papers are being processed. United States immigration laws are stringent. It would have been an act of total irresponsibility to have tried to find a loophole, especially since it would have put my family's well-being at risk. I wondered if I was allowed to write. Writing is my work, after all. But of course I did write, and will write, because it's what I can do. And I knew that if I did not write this particular story, it would not have made sense to return to writing anything else. Why did you come to the United States? Perhaps no one knows the real answer. I know that migrants, when they are still on their way here, learn the immigrant's prayer. A friend who had been aboard La Bestia for a few days, working on a documentary, read it to me once. I didn't learn the entire thing, but I remember these lines. Partir es morir un poco. Llegar nunca es llegar. To leave is to die a little. To arrive is never to arrive. I've had to ask so many children, why did you come? Sometimes I ask myself the same question. I don't have an answer yet. Before coming to the United States, I knew what others know, that the cruelty of its borders was only a thin crust, and that on the other side, a possible life was waiting. I understood some time after that once you stay here long enough, you begin to remember the place where you originally came from, the way a backyard might look from a high window in the deep of winter. A skeleton of the world. A tract of abandonment. Objects dead and obsolete. And once you're here, you're ready to give everything, or almost everything, to stay and play a part in the great theater of belonging. In the United States, to stay is an end in itself and not a means. To stay is the founding myth of this society. To stay in the United States, you will unlearn the universal metric system so you can buy a pound and a half of cooked ham, except that 32 degrees, and not zero, is where the line falls that divides cold and freezing. You might even begin to celebrate the pilgrims who remove the alien Indians, and the veterans who maybe killed other aliens, and the day of a president who will eventually declare a war on all the other so-called aliens. No matter the cost. No matter the cost of the rent and milk and cigarettes, the humiliations, the daily battles. You will give everything. You will convince yourself that it is only a matter of time before you can be yourself again, in America, despite the added layers of its otherness already so well adhered to your skin. But perhaps you will never want to be your former self again. There are too many things that ground you to this new life. Why did you come here? I asked one little girl once. Because I wanted to arrive. Coda. 8 brief postscripts. 1. Now it is the year 2017, and I finally have a green card. And the world is so upside fucking down that Trump somehow became president of the United States, and President Enrique Peña Nieto in Mexico restitched the entire Mexican landscape, previously tattered, to turn it into a warm welcome doormat for Trumpland. 2. We should have predicted it,
but we did not. I should have foreseen some of it. I am a novelist, which means my mind is trained to read the world as part of a narrative plot, where some events foreshadow others. One early morning, for example, a few months before the election, I was standing in front of the bathroom mirror in my Harlem apartment next to my 6-year-old daughter. We were playing with face paint. Yellow stripes on my forehead, green dots on hers, a blue spot on my nose. At one point, she dug her index finger into the miniature bucket of white paint, and as she spread it across her cheek, she said, "Look, Mama, now I'm getting ready for when Trump is president, so they won't know we're Mexicans." 3. Many of us are falling apart, and so, it seems, is everything good. Except a few things. There's the TIA, for example, which, though still small, has become a fully active group. Its first public action took place on September 26, 2016, the same day as the first presidential debate, which, as it happened, was hosted on our campus at Hofstra University. The TIA students prepared inspired speeches for the protests that would take place on campus the day of the debate. Looking for ways to support them, I went online and ordered them T-shirts that said, "Refugees welcome here." Last minute, I ordered one for myself, too, though I never wear T-shirts. The TIA members that day were a riot, a beautiful, messy bunch. Throughout the day, they sent me SMS messages with pictures and videos of their actions on campus. The best picture was one of a student who made a poster saying, "Refugees welcome here," and stood behind a life-size cardboard replica of a thumbs-up Donald Trump. 4. A few weeks later, the TIA decided to organize a soccer match and booked one of the better fields on campus for the game. In a rush, we all tried to recruit as many teenagers recently arrived in Hempstead as possible. Only 5 people arrived. A girl from Honduras and her mother, a Salvadoran boy who was dropped off by his uncle, a boy from Honduras who arrived on public transport from Hempstead, and, to my absolute joy, Manu, whom I've been trying to contact for some time with little luck, and had managed to reach. As we all walked toward the fields together, I noticed hundreds of migrating birds flocking in the autumn sky above us. The strange yet beautiful irony of it. Once we reached the field, Manu was made captain of one team, and was visibly proud of it. A TIA student was made captain of the other. The final score was 7-10. When that TIA soccer match was over, one student offered to drive Manu home and then take me to the station to catch my train back to Manhattan. When we dropped Manu off in front of his house in Hempstead, my student told me something I won't forget. "You know, I never thought the kids we've been reading and talking about in abstract all this time would actually be riding in the back seat of my car one day. I'm proud of being part of this." 5. The day Trump won the election, when I finally gathered enough willpower to get out of bed, I put on that "Refugees Welcome Here" T-shirt, made myself a watery coffee, and left my house. Long strides down the street, Kendrick Lamar's song "All Right" playing on repeat on my headphones, feeling like I was ready for anything. I rode the A down to Penn Station to catch my train to Long Island. When I walked into the train car, the first thing I saw was a 20-something-year-old man wearing a red "Make America, etc." cap. I felt a visceral urge to insult him or throw something at him, but I did not. For the better or worse, my body is incapable of reacting aggressively. Instead, I walked over to him, shyly asked him to remove the headphones he was wearing, and then mumbled and stuttered a way too emotional sentence about empathy and social responsibility. In response, he laughed loudly in my face. So I took a seat and opened a book, forcing myself not to cry or look scared. 6. When I arrived in the university and walked into a classroom later that day, I noticed my TIA students there were wearing the same T-shirt I was, "Refugees Welcome Here." And it was hard, at first, not to cry. Difficult not to expose my absolute fragility in front of the group. But a few minutes later, They were all raising their hands and having crazy ideas and making wild, revolutionary plans to counter the uncertainty that lay ahead of us. I sat on top of my professor's desk, cross-legged, and listened and smiled and maybe even laughed with them. 7. I know it'll take much more than the meteoric enthusiasm of a bunch of college kids to resist the dark years ahead. But if I have been able to retain some sanity, it's thanks to a handful of Tias organizing soccer matches and English classes. I look forward to the Tias and their generation. If we all manage to pull through in these next years, it'll be thanks to young people who are willing to give their minds and hearts and bodies to make changes. There is a young man in the Tia who immigrated from Ghana to Spain when he was little and later became a soccer player, and was then brought over to the U.S. because of his skills, and now leads the Tia soccer games. Just because he thinks that's what's right. There's a young woman who works many shifts to pay her tuition, and has to explain to her boss that yes, she's brown, and yes, she supports immigrant children, but that she's also a decent citizen, and even patriotic. If patriotic means loving and defending an inclusive, egalitarian country. There's another young man who brings a skateboard to class and is half Colombian, half Turkish, and yet fully American at the same time. And he is developing a complex plan to teach civil rights and skateboarding to refugee teenagers. People ask him if he's Catholic or Muslim or what, and he says he doesn't know, but that maybe he'll be a writer or photographer one day. And there's a young man who gently combs his right eyebrow with his thumb and says, "No, prof. Nuh-uh. We won't take it. We won't comply." And another young woman who says, "Prof, we gotta turn all our emotional shit into political capital, yo." 8. Manu has SIJ status now. He has found a church where he feels welcome, and he has mentors at Strong who have helped him pull through. He's also learning English with the Tias and comes to play soccer on campus sometimes. He told me he wanted his real name to be disclosed in this book so he could send it to family and friends back in Honduras. But because he is yet to apply for a green card, and times are dire and volatile, immigration lawyers we consulted thought it best to maintain his anonymity. When I told him this, he said, "Okay, fine. No pasa nada." In the meantime, he said, he'll be practicing the art of flight in his front yard in Hempstead.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Tell Me How It Ends, an essay in 40 questions, by Valeria Luiselli, read by Laurence Bouvard. This program was produced by ID Audio. Text copyright 2017 by Valeria Luiselli. Introduction copyright 2017 by John Lee Anderson. Production copyright 2017, HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.